Hello and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor with McLean's Magazine.
We're now in the sprint at the end of a marathon. The federal election campaign is nearing an end, with Canadians casting their ballots on Monday. It's crunch time for the party leaders, and they're making their final pitch to voters. Here to talk about the end of the campaign is NDP leader Thomas Mulcair.
This campaign has been a wild ride since it all began on August 2nd, and it seems no one knows exactly how it's all going to turn out. Pollster Frank Graves with Ecos Research is here to tell us where the parties stand before E-Day and how support has shifted throughout the campaign.
The McLean's panel looks at different scenarios that could be in play on October 20th and what they'll mean for our country.
The former Canadian ambassador to Iran, Ken Taylor, who was the mastermind behind the Canadian caper during the Iran hostage crisis, has died at the age of 81. We speak with a couple of Taylor's old friends, including former Prime Minister Brian Mulroney.
For your politics, for your power, welcome to The Hill. It's been the longest election campaign in modern Canadian history, and it's going to be a fight to the finish. This is the final weekend before Canadians head to the polls to choose their next government on Monday. No one is willing to give up as all three major party leaders hit the campaign trail for one last push to try and sway as many swing voters as possible.
All leaders will be trying to hold massive rallies to show strength in enemy territory, like the NDP in Edmonton, the Conservatives in Toronto, and the Liberals will end their campaign in Calgary, where they could win a seat or two for the first time since 1968. In their final pleas to voters, both Liberal leader Justin Trudeau and Conservative leader Stephen Harper are framing this as a two-way race, and Trudeau is making the case for change.
After 10 years in power, Stephen Harper's government is out of ideas and completely out of touch. We can replace them with a better government, not just a different government. It's time for real change.
But Harper, whose Conservatives are trailing in second, is warning voters to resist the urge for change. He's using pocketbook issues in the economy to keep the Tory chances alive.
The choice in this time of global economic uncertainty could not be clearer. It is the choice between balanced budgets or ongoing deficits, between lower taxes or higher taxes.
And while the NDP is sitting in a distant third, that's not breaking the confidence of leader Thomas Mulcair, who seems to have a bounce in his step after the Liberal co-chair was forced to resign. Dan Gagne stepped down in controversy after it was revealed that while he was working on the GRIT campaign, he sent an email with lobbying advice to TransCanada, the company behind the Energy East pipeline. NDP leader Thomas Mulcair joined me by phone from Quebec to discuss the end of the campaign.
It's the last weekend before the election. How are you feeling? It's been a long campaign.
Feeling energized. I've been meeting people from coast to coast to coast who want change, and they know that with the Liberals, you get more of the same of the sponsorship scandal. We saw that this week in the Dan Gagne affair, lobbying, you know, giving strategic advice to oil companies and pipeline companies from the campaign bus and from the war room of Justin Trudeau. It was just a reminder that the Liberals only want to come back for themselves, that the Conservatives have a track record of corruption, and for the first time in 148 years, there's a real choice. The NDP is the official opposition for the first time, and Canadians who want change have the possibility of bringing that change with a good NDP government on Monday, October 19th.
You sound very confident, but how do you convince voters that you can actually pull something like that off? Your party is polling in the 20s. You're in a distant third to both the Conservatives and the Liberals.
Well, one of the things that I've learned in my political career is that you can't put a poll in a ballot box. You have to get people to vote. And the people that I've been meeting from coast to coast to coast have been saying one thing, first and foremost, that they want change. This is the first three-way race in Canadian political history. And people who are so tired of what they've had under Stephen Harper and want change are now looking at the Liberals and the Dan Gagne, the TransCanada pipeline scandal, and realizing, oh my gosh, the Liberals haven't changed at all. This is the same old gang that just wants to get back. There is one way to have positive change for your family, for your community, for good jobs in Canada, for health care. That's with the NDP.
But we also know that there's a strong Liberal base, and I think some may argue that if the NDP and the Liberals split again, then it's just going to be another Conservative government.
The best way to avoid conservative government is to vote NDP. Because with the Liberals, you get Bill C-51, which Mr. Trudeau voted for. You get the Keystone XL pipeline, which Mr. Trudeau approves, as does Mr. Harper. You will have no targets on climate change. You have $50 billion in tax giveaways for Canada's richest corporations. And you get the Trans-Pacific Partnership. The NDP understands that the TPP will increase drug costs for seniors, will cost tens of thousands of Canadians well-paid jobs across the country. And so there's a different way possible, a different way forward. It's with a positive, forward-looking NDP government that says, let's work together. We started something big in 2011 when we became official opposition for the first time. And this time, we have every intention of forming an NDP government on Monday, October 19th.
You have talked about the scenarios of what happens moving forward. It's in your party platform about working with other Federalist parties to prevent another Harper government. So I guess one question that this begs is, have any of your staff members contacted the Liberals about what your two parties will do if the Conservatives win another minority government?
Well, it's true that the NDP is the only party that put that in their platform, and we think that it's important that Canadians know that my priority is to defeat and replace Stephen Harper. Back in 2008, when we knew that we had to get rid of the Conservatives because they weren't even admitting that we were in a recession, whereas we were in the worst depression since the 1930s, Mr. Trudeau signed a coalition agreement, and then he walked away from his own signature. And the problem for Canadians, of course, is that 7 years later, we're still stuck with Stephen Harper. So we've always known what our priorities are, and I have opened the door any number of times to cooperating with the Liberals, and every time I've done that, Mr. Trudeau has slammed the door shut. So that's something else that Canadians have to know. And in this election campaign, it's important to know that the NDP goes into this election with 100 seats in Parliament. We only need 35 more seats to defeat Stephen Harper. Justin Trudeau's Liberals only have 30-odd seats in Parliament, and they need 100 more seats to be able to defeat Stephen Harper. That's also something that Canadians should concentrate on as they're marking their ballots this Monday.
To be fair on that, though, when the writ is dropped, nobody holds a seat. So everybody goes back to zero on that. I know it's a line that you've been putting out there, but technically, everybody goes back to zero. Nobody has any seats.
The NDP entered this campaign with 100 members of Parliament, and we need 35 more members of Parliament to defeat Stephen Harper's Conservatives. The Liberals entered this campaign with 30-some-odd MPs. They would need to add 100 MPs for them to be able to defeat Stephen Harper. That's something that Canadians should be thinking about when they mark their ballots on Monday.
Back to the question I asked just before that that issue, though. Aside from your open call to say that you're, you know, open to the idea of working with the Liberals, have any of your staff members actually contacted the Liberal Party? Have there been any talks between the Liberals and NDP about what would happen if the Conservatives return to power?
We did put it in our platform that we were open to working with other Federalist parties, and that's a reflection of what I've been saying throughout the past several years. I've even said it as recently as July, and Mr. Trudeau shut the door on that. It was the NDP that proposed a formal coalition with the Liberals in 2008, and that's the party we are, always open to working with others.
Will you be the leader no matter what happens or where your party finishes in the polls on October 20th? Do you plan on sticking around and being the leader if let's say, you know, your hope of a government doesn't come true?
On October 19th, the NDP will be forming the first progressive social democratic government in our country's history. And that's because Canadians want change, and they're fed up with being told for 148 years that they have no choice but to rotate between Liberal corruption and Conservative corruption. Canadians deserve better. And on Monday, October 19th, they can get just that, a much better government with the NDP.
But will you be leader no matter what? You're planning on sticking around?
As Canada's next Prime Minister on Monday, October 19th, I will proudly serve Canadians from coast to coast to coast.
There are two projection sites that show you may have some troubles in your own riding. I'm wondering if you could address that. Are you having problems in your own riding? Because some of them show that it's a very tight race between yourself and the Liberal.
We have a very strong base in our riding. We have every confidence that the people of Outremont will renew their confidence in me for the fourth time on Monday. There's no doubt in my mind about that.
Now, the Gagné issue, which you've referenced a number of times, obviously is not a good scenario for the Liberals, especially just before Election Day. How sure are you that none of your staff have committed a similar offense?
The only party in this election campaign where a senior advisor has been found to have been providing strategic advice on lobbying to an outside company is the Liberal Party of Canada. And it's what Canadians are starting to realize, and it's something that I've said since the beginning of this campaign, that for the first time in 148 years, Canadians who want change have a real choice. And I've been speaking to Canadians about that across the country. Actions speak louder than words. And you know what? The Liberals are not there for Canadians. They're there for themselves, on the backs of Canadians. My priority is to replace Stephen Harper, and Liberals and Conservatives are showing that they simply don't deserve Canadians' confidence.
You're calling for an inquiry on rail safety. If rail safety is such a concern, wouldn't pipelines be the answer to that, to try and ship crude across the country?
As we've seen in the explosions in other places that have taken that have occurred, such as Plaster Rock in New Brunswick or Kigoma in northern Ontario, rail safety is a real concern. 15 years ago, the Liberals started deregulating rail and asking companies to do the job themselves instead of having government inspectors looking at that crucial infrastructure. We want to sit down and have a report from experts, and it'll be a public inquiry. We'll find out what types of conditions could lead to a tragedy like Lac-Mégantic, and we'll put in place and rigorously enforce tough new rules on rail safety in Canada.
The Conservatives offered, the government, the PCO, offered a technical briefing to the other parties to look over the exact wording of the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal. But yourselves and the Liberals have rejected that offer. Obviously, you can't speak for the Liberals, but for yourself, why wouldn't you take advantage of that? You've been calling to see the details of the TPP.
The NDP has been calling for Stephen Harper to make public the details of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It is completely ridiculous for Mr. Harper, 3 days away from an election, to say he's willing to show the details to his political opponents, but they're not allowed to talk about it to the public. That is utmost bad faith on the part of Stephen Harper.
That was NDP leader Thomas Mulcair discussing the end of the federal election campaign. Remember, before you vote on Monday, head to macleans.ca or pick up the latest issue of Maclean's magazine. We have election primers, which will help you decide who has the best plan for our country on some of the major issues facing Canadians. We've broken down where the parties stand and what the experts are saying. Also, in the latest issue, we have reports from the three major leaders' campaigns, so pick it up at newsstands or check it out online.
Still to come on the show, we speak with pollster Frank Graves about the ebbs and flows of support in this campaign. Maclean's panel looks at the possible scenarios this election could bring the House of Commons, and former Prime Minister Brian Mulroney remembers Ken Taylor, the former ambassador to Iran who is the inspiration for the movie Argo.
Welcome back to Maclean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor with Maclean's Magazine.
Coming up on the show, the Maclean's panel discusses the possible outcomes of this election, and former Prime Minister Brian Mulroney remembers Ken Taylor, the Canadian ambassador to Iran who was the mastermind behind the Canadian caper during the Iran hostage crisis. But first,
going into this final weekend of the campaign, most polls show the Liberals ahead, the Tories in second, and the NDP in third. It's been a tight, tough race, challenging for pollsters as well as politicians. John Geddes caught up with Frank Graves, president of Ecos Research, for both his snapshot of where the parties stand in these final frantic days of campaigning, and also, maybe more importantly, a perspective on the unexpected ways this marathon race has unfolded.
Our latest sees the race tightening. The Liberals are basically in a statistical tie now, a point and a half up on the Conservatives, and the NDP are in the mid-low 20s, but sort of hanging in there. So I had thought when I saw some movements on the weekend, after the weekend, that we were beginning to see some clarity emerging, and it looked like the Liberals might be taking off and in position to secure at least a minority. At this point, that still might be true, but it's not obvious at all in the current data. It appears to be, once again, a really muddy kind of deadlock. And I don't think people realize the NDP, even though they're back, their vote is pretty seat efficient. They're looking very strong in Quebec, and they're looking reasonably good in British Columbia. They're going to win a fair number of seats. So ironically, even though they may be reduced by maybe 15 or 20 seats from last time out, they're probably going to have a lot more power, because it increasingly looks like this is going to be a minority, and the balance of power is going to be exerted by, I would imagine, the NDP. So, you know, it remains a very unpredictable race, and frankly, a bit of a pollster nightmare.
Why do you say a pollster nightmare? Is it?
Well, because there's a lot of, if you're off by, you know, 2 or 3 points here, it changes who's in first and second. There's a lot of new ridings with different configurations. We don't know how the vote splitting will work in those areas. The critical issue is really turnout. The reason we and others got so shocked by the majority outcome last time
in 2011,
nobody predicted,
yeah,
because we didn't see what was a huge advantage for the Conservatives on turnout.
More of their declared supporters actually went and voted than declared supporters of other parties.
Yeah, we did a post-election survey, so essentially, of the 60% who voted, roughly 40% of them voted Conservative. That person of the population, they had 40% share. But of the 40% that didn't vote, the Conservative support was more in the 25% range.
Wow.
And that actually links back to an interesting technical issue, which is actually really, really important in terms of seeing where this election is going to end up, and that is the cell phone population, the cell phone-only population. One-third of Canadians have cut their landlines and won't be reached through landline surveys. They have very distinct profile, but they also continue to be much less likely to support the Conservative government.
Is that because they're younger, Frank? Is that the main reason?
Yeah, they're younger, less affluent. There's two things that are different about them this time. First of all, they're much larger. They're, you know, a bigger share of the population. And second of all, they tell us this time they're going to show up and vote. They tell us they're certain to vote. Whether that translates into...
And they didn't do that last time, sir?
Not at all. No. They were much less likely to vote. There was a 25 or 30 point gap in their participation rates compared to other parts, people who had landlines or both cell phones.
So, Frank, can I stop you on that point? So let's say I'm a younger voter. I have only a cell phone, not a landline. In 2011, I was saying, I don't think I'm going to vote. Well, when you say that they're more likely to vote this time, I can't help but think that it's either the nature of the debate or the nature of the candidates, the leaders running. Which do you think it
is?
Well,
it's a little bit of each. But it's also, remember, this is a much bigger group. Mm-hmm. And so the cell phone-only population was relatively rarefied. It was, you know, maybe 11%. It's probably at least 25 and maybe 30% this time. But there's other things that have happened, and that's one of the interesting phenomena that I think we'll, in retrospect, see as having shaped this election, is that the shift in the election from all about the economy to all about values and all about the kneecap produced strong emotional engagement and restored a lot of the Conservative base that showed up and gave them their majority in 2011.
Frank, can I interrupt you just for a second? Yeah. I just want to clarify for listeners the point that you're making here. So you're saying that up until some stage in this campaign, it looked like it was a campaign about economic questions, and then something tripped it into a different category of a sort of values-based election. And I think I'm right in thinking you think it was the NICAB issue, maybe the Syrian refugee issue, stuff like that.
Definitely think it started with the Syrian refugee issue. And
right.
At that point, we know there was this consensus, oh, my God, Harper's now really made a fatal mistake, and this is so appalling.
By not seeming more empathetic.
Yeah, by not being so hard-hearted.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is just offside, and his minister didn't help. And everyone's going, well, that's it.
Yeah.
In fact, interestingly enough, I wasn't convinced that was the case at the time, but we started noticing in the following days that Mr. Harper went from mid-20s and climbed successfully for the next 3 or 4 days to the point where he then secured a lead significantly, which he held for 20 days in our polling.
Wow.
And that was reinforced, I think, not just by the Syrian refugee crisis, where, interestingly enough, although this was seen as an appalling lack of compassion on the part of certainly a lot of the commentary and many Canadians, Most conservative supporters, only 10% thought there were too few Syrian refugees coming.
They thought the security issue was more important, maybe.
Yeah, in fact, they didn't think there was too few. They thought there was too many,
right,
by almost 40%. And that was followed up, of course, with the messaging on NICAB. We're going to have hotlines to report barbaric cultural practices. The NICAB will not just be banned at citizenship ceremonies. Why not public service? This, I think, worked for a while for Mr. Harper, and it continues to be why he's doing well with his base, because the distraction, he wasn't winning on the economy issue, and this distraction and shift to these issues was successful. But I think, ironically, what it did is it's now provoked a pretty strong emotional response, a values-based response in the rest of the spectrum, what I might call the moderate majority or the progressive majority, who have seen this issue. And regardless if they agree with Mr. Harper on the specifics of what should happen at citizenship ceremonies, they really are offside on some of the broader value questions about what kind of country we'd like to see handed off to our children, how we want to be seen in the external world, what is our basic sense of right or wrong, good or bad. Those values questions are very emotionally charged, and I think this election, which was supposed to be all about the economy, it was an important election, but all about the economy, is now seen as a historic election all about values.
That was veteran pollster Frank Graves of Ecos Research in conversation with McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes.
Still to come, the McLean's panel joins us to discuss the possible outcomes of this tight race, and we speak with former Prime Minister Brian Mulroney about the life of Ken Taylor, the Canadian ambassador to Iran during the hostage crisis, whose heroics were detailed in the movie Argo. Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor with McLean's Magazine.
Still to come on the show, former Prime Minister Brian Mulroney remembers Ken Taylor, the former ambassador to Iran, who was the mastermind behind the Canadian caper during the hostage crisis that inspired the movie Argo. But first, it's now time for the McLean's panel. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for McLean's, and McLean Senior Writer, Laura Payton. Thanks very much for joining me, guys.
Hi.
All right, so let's talk about possible outcomes of this election. It's still kind of a tight race. The polls show the Liberals are ahead, the Conservatives are behind, but maybe not that far behind, and we have the NDP trailing in third. Aaron, we'll start with you. What do you think are the most likely outcomes out of this, and what should Canadians be expecting or counting out?
I mean, I guess presumably we're looking at either a Liberal or a Liberal or a Conservative government as the most likely outcomes. I mean, there's still so much that you can't know. How accurate have the polls been? How strong are these parties on the ground? What could possibly move in the last 2 days? I think the NDP is running obviously a clear third, but even there, it's hard to know exactly how that's going to translate to seats. Of the parties, you would have to think the Liberals are basically the untested one, the one we can't really be sure of at this point in terms of their ground organization, in terms of how they can get their vote out. And so there's a lot kind of unknown at this point, I think.
Should we not be counting out then an NDP government? Because they're pretty far behind in the polls, but Thomas Mulcair in my interview earlier in the show had said that he's still confident there can be an orange wave.
I'm going to be a contrarian on this just because I think that it's hard to rule anything out. We've seen some big shifts. It's hard to know, like Aaron said, how accurate the polls are. And this is also a good time for me to point out that Paul Wells wanted us to say, to put it on the record, that Paul thinks that the Conservatives are resurging right now. He thinks there's stuff going on the ground, like flyer drops and things that we don't necessarily see from Ottawa. And he thinks the Conservatives are making a comeback over the weekend. like I said, I'm not going to rule anything out. I'm still going to fill in my election pool this week and pick a winner, but it's really hard to know right now how it's going to happen.
And we've seen some of that already with the ads coming out in languages like Punjabi and I believe Mandarin that have been in some community publications saying, if the Liberals win, you're going to have drug injection sites next to your home. You're going to have brothels and the selling of women. Aaron, do you think that that's going to sway a lot of votes at the last minute?
I don't know if necessarily that line of attack is going to do anything, but it does underscore the fact that there's a lot going on out there that we just sort of don't know about or sort of out of sight. The attention goes to the leaders' tours. The attention goes to the big ad buys on television, the major controversies. But in terms of organization, in terms of what people are getting at the door, in terms of, what's going on in certain ethnic media, it's really, there's a lot going on in a campaign at any one time that we just don't know about. And you have to allow for that possibility that there's going to be some impact. I mean, that said, I think if you had to wager, you'd have to wager right now that the Liberals are going to come out ahead on Monday night. You would have to give them the advantage. But with all those caveats that I've had before, that we just don't know how organized they are. And the Conservatives and the NDP are generally considered formidable organizational machines.
All right. So if we get to October 20th, and we have a Liberal government, it seems like the NDP would probably prop it up. They haven't counted that out yet. But what we have seen is the NDP and the Liberals counting out any support for the Conservatives. So what happens if the Conservatives do return with a minority government?
I think if the Conservatives come back, they'll probably wheel and deal so that their minority stays in power. I don't know exactly what they could offer, for example, the NDP. I can see the NDP and the Liberals having an easier time despite all the bad blood between them, just because I think the Liberals could, for example, offer some of the NDP platform promises on healthcare or on childcare. I don't think it would be that hard or that big a deviation for the Liberals to do that. I have a harder time seeing the Conservatives making those kinds of offers, although, when somebody's staring down losing power, I can see them moving in a way that lets them keep it.
But the credibility of the two other parties would be on the line because both of them have said they will not support the Conservatives.
Yeah, I mean, my working assumption has been that unless the Conservatives have a majority or a very, very strong minority, that they're done, that the Liberals and the NDP would be compelled somehow or another to come together and change the situation. Now, I mean, if it's 150 seats to 100, if there's a big gap between first and second, that maybe comes into play. There's all sorts of considerations and caveats to that, but I just think there would be too much pressure on the Liberals and the NDP to do something internally within their party rank and file. And I think even sort of publicly, there would be some sense of wanting change, especially, because it doesn't look like there's going to be a big gap between the Conservatives and the Liberals. It looks like at most it's going to be pretty close. So, I think we're looking at, sort of one way or another, I think we're probably looking at Justin Trudeau being prime minister very soon.
So do you think the prime minister, the Conservative leader, his job is on the line with this one? If he doesn't return with a majority, Laura, that Harper will not remain as the Conservative leader?
Yeah, I mean, I've been hearing from a lot of Conservatives who really support the party, and they, even to a point, support Stephen Harper because they respect and admire what he's done for them over the years, but they don't like his methods. And I'm not talking about people sitting in Ottawa who are friendly with the media. I'm talking about people who I have encountered over the past year or two at conventions or just even by making phone calls to different riding associations. Once in a while, I chat with people like that. And they aren't entirely happy with how Stephen Harper has run the Prime Minister's office or the people he's surrounded himself with. And I think that there's going to be a lot of blame to go around. I mean, that happens in political parties whenever there's a loss. But I think particularly in this party, when you've seen a leadership that's not only been mean-spirited with people they consider to be enemies, but even with people who they consider to be friends within their party.
So that sounds like it's not in a good situation at the moment.
No, I mean, I can always be surprised, but I think that Stephen Harper, if he doesn't return with at least a minority, is going to have a hard time retaining the leadership of the party.
Now, anytime we see a party drop in the number of seats in the House of Commons, usually the question pops up about whether they're going to hang around or not, whether the party base will get upset and try and turf them. For the Liberals, it seems clear they're on their way up. They're going to at least double their seats in the House of Commons, according to all the projections. But the NDP, it's a different story. Aaron, we're going to see them possibly drop if the projections are correct. What happens with leader Thomas Mulcair after that? Because I asked him about that, and he just has his eyes on the prize and doesn't want to think about anything else or talk about anything else. But if he loses that official opposition status, what happens to Thomas Mulcair?
It'll be very interesting to see how the NDP reacts to this election. If you go back, you know, 5 years ago and imagine where they are now. If you'd asked a New Democrat, you know, how do you feel about winning 80 seats in an election, they would have been overjoyed. But in this case, it's going to seem like a big slip from where they were less than 2 months ago when it seemed like they were headed for government. It's interesting. It'll be very interesting to see how they react to that, whether they feel good about being a strong third and sort of having established themselves, or whether that loses out to, gosh, we were so close and we didn't get it. You know, Tom Mulcair has not had a terrible leadership, and it doesn't look like he's going to bottom out like the Liberals did in 2011. So you would think he would be okay to at least carry on for a while. That said, he's 62 years old. I don't know, whether he wants to be leader for another 4 years, whether they want to move in a different direction. If it is a minority parliament, it's conceivable that we're looking at another election in 2 years. So, you know, maybe he hangs on for a while. The other part of that would be if there's any obvious successor that people are clamoring for, and I don't know that there is at this point, that will also play into it. But it is the NDP is going to have a very sort of like glass half full, glass half empty moment after this election, and it'll be interesting to see how they sort of deal with that.
I find the expectations in this election really odd, like Aaron touched on with, the NDP 5 years ago would have been thrilled with 80 seats. The Liberals, by all means, should be thrilled to double their seat count, but you might actually have people disappointed if they don't do better than that, because at this point in the polls, it looks like they could maybe even quadruple their seats. And who knows if they can sustain that through Monday or if that's even accurate. But it kind of plays with your head and with the head of the people who are working with the parties, because the expectations are so, I don't know if warped is the right word, but the expectations are so different because of how the summer's gone.
And I guess a bit of a reality check for everybody. No party in Canadian history has moved from third party status to government in one election. But then again, we've also only had two parties trading government back and forth for the history of the country. And let's just talk about these last minute votes again. We've had a couple of issues pop up for the Conservatives and the Liberals, mainly the Liberals. This is where the focus is, with Dan Gagne and the email controversy after he sent an email to TransCanada giving them advice on how to lobby a new government, including a Liberal minority government. And, even Liberal leader Justin Trudeau says that was unacceptable and it was inappropriate. So how could this impact the Liberal vote at the end? Is this too little too late for the other parties to try and cause a Liberal vote to collapse?
I think it came really late in the campaign, if it had even happened, not Monday, because that would have been the long weekend, but if it happened, say, on Tuesday, I think the Conservatives and the NDP could have made a bit more out of it. I think coming on a Wednesday night and a Thursday, when the Jays are winning in a pretty big game, a dramatic game, and some of the other stuff that's going on, I don't know that they're going to be able to take advantage of it over the weekend.
Yeah, I don't know if it's enough. I also just don't know if it's a big enough issue. I mean, obviously it's an issue, but I don't know if it's a major controversy. It does hurt. I mean, I think, you know, if the image of Justin Trudeau and this Liberal Party is that it's about change and about, you know, being new and it's a new chapter, and suddenly you've got this sort of echo to the, you know, the reason the Liberals lost government a decade ago, that's not helpful. I'm very interested. I would be interested by any voter who at this point is still trying to make up their mind It's been a freaking long campaign, and if you're still troubled by how you should be voting, I'm amazed. But it will take. It wouldn't surprise me if it slows their momentum just a touch.
And for the conservatives, the Ford Nation, the Ford factor, do you think the Fords are going to be a plus or a minus to the conservatives at the end of this? As much as a lot of people who are decided against the conservatives find it a joke, let's face it. I mean, the Ford brothers do bring out a lot of the conservative base, especially in Toronto.
Yeah, I don't know. It's always hard to know what's going to impact votes. As we've seen in this election, we're all just guessing. But I think it maybe does help with their base in certain pockets of the GTA. But I do wonder whether there are a sizable number of voters who are looking at that and thinking, you know, Stephen Harper, as Paul touched on a bit in his piece this week, you know, Stephen Harper is supposed to be the serious guy in the room, and what's he doing with Rob Ford and Doug Ford at this point? It's not the image I would necessarily want to go into Election Day with.
And on that image, we will end the panel. Thank you very much. McLean's Associate Editor, Aaron Wherry, McLean's Senior Writer, Laura Payton, and I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
Coming up after the break, former diplomat Colin Robertson and former Prime Minister Brian Mulroney remember Ken Taylor, the former ambassador to Iran who orchestrated the Canadian caper during the Iran hostage crisis, which inspired the movie Argo.
Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wherry, Associate Editor with McLean's Magazine.
Ken Taylor, the Canadian diplomat celebrated for his role in hiding six Americans in the Canadian embassy in Tehran in 1979 during the Iran hostage crisis, died this week of cancer. He was 81 years old.
In a moment, we'll hear the thoughts of former Prime Minister Brian Mulroney. But before that, John Geddes talked with another former Canadian diplomat, Colin Robertson, who worked as a young Foreign Service officer under Taylor in the early 1980s.
Just generally, responses to the news of Ken Taylor passing.
Well, Ken was a great Canadian patriot, a hero, but Ken was also really cool. I first met him when I, as a junior officer, when I was posted to New York, and of course, he had already performed the great Canadian caper in Tehran, and the government had appointed him as our consul general in New York, partly because of his celebrity and because of the magnetism that Ken had, and because of the importance of New York in terms of the diplomatic establishment. Hmm. And he took the town like a storm. Anywhere he went, in fact, even before he arrived, we got a first sense of it because we'd go up, we have to show our tax cards, and they saw we were Canadian, and Americans everywhere would thank us for what Ken had done.
We obviously all know him because of the Canadian caper, but can you talk to us about what he was like, you know, beyond that remarkable episode that obviously, you know, changed his place in our perception? Was he, what kind of a diplomat was he? What kind of a guy was he in on the job?
Well, he was an unconventional diplomat, certainly by that era. First of all, he didn't wear the classic blue suit. He was always in a fashionable suit that suited him. And of course, he had that great buffet of hair, all the curls, and then his dark glasses, which were his kind of signature.
Right.
But and always a smile on his face. He was highly approachable and personable. Mm. And the first thing I noticed after he came to the office, coming down to see him, is that he had no desk in his office. It was a coffee table. You sat around in a sort of salon style, and we would talk about the issues, and that was fine, and then he'd deal with it. I traveled with him as a junior officer who did, and in his briefcase there was always a novel, I think, things like The Bonfire of the Vanities, or a magazine, Sports Illustrated. It wasn't the heavy-duty stuff. I remember Ken teasing me. I was traveling with a copy of Foreign Affairs, and he says, Colin, you've got to lighten up. Read a thriller or something, and pointing out then in our conversation, this was on the bar car from Grand Central Station to this one particular episode that really sticks with me. We were traveling up to Yale where he had a series of speeches to give, and we didn't take the car. He said, "No, we're going to take the train because we could go the bar car, have a martini." This, you know, after we'd had oysters at Grand Central Station, and then we talked, and he sort of gave me a sense of diplomacy. What he pointed out is really important to understand society in the whole. If you were going to be a good diplomat, it wasn't just straight political or economic or trade. It was understanding the culture in which you were working and having an empathy for it. And Ken had empathy for everybody, including the Iranian people. This certainly struck with me because, remember, this was a time when the Iranians were not terribly popular because of what had happened in the United States. But he made a point of, in his own gentle way, of encouraging Americans that while they may have a disagreement with the Ayatollah and the ruling elite in Tehran, the Iranian people, in fact, had great affection to America and never break those links. And you know, years later, I would see Ken over at various things over time, the Toronto International Film Festival, which he was a real habitué because he loved films. Hmm. But he was strongly opposed to the government closing the embassy and felt that we should maintain those links because it was so important for Canada to be able to be there, just to be on the ground, seeing what's happening, and then be able to share that with our allies because we had this kind of entree.
That was former diplomat Colin Robertson talking with Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes.
Now, Robertson wasn't the only one to share his views with us. I was able to speak with former Prime Minister Brian Mulroney about the life of Ken Taylor.
Well, I was not in office at the time. So I followed it like everyone else, and I was very impressed with Ken's leadership and his courage and his judgment in doing what he did. He acted in the very best interests of Canada and put us on the diplomatic map around the world in a major way, doing the right thing at all times. So I came to know him later on in life very well. We became very good friends over the years, and it was an honor to know him.
What kind of person was he? I mean, a lot of people saw his heroic actions, but may not have known the man, Ken Taylor. So what can you tell us about that?
Well, look, he was a fun-loving, entertaining, delightful guy. He was hardworking and devoted to his responsibilities. But he loved New York, for example. He loved the Big Apple, loved to have a good time, and was, of course, well-known and celebrated there for his great work on behalf of Canada. So I knew Ken and Pat, his wonderful wife, very well, and he had made a fabulous contribution to Canada and to our reputation around the world, and it was highly valued and appreciated by not only Americans, but others who understand the nuances and the importance of leadership in diplomacy.
What's a fond memory? What's a memory you're going to look back on your personal experiences with him that you'll always keep with you?
Oh, look, I had many. He was just a delightful guy to be with. My memory of him is going to be how such an accomplished diplomat and trade expert, how he fitted in so well after he stood down and enjoyed his life to the hilt, and was always so gracious and kind.
You were prime minister sort of in the wake of all of that.
Yes.
So when it comes to Canada on the global stage, I know you sort of touched on that, but what do you think the impact was and how you handled global affairs?
Well, I'll take myself right out of the mix because the fellow who deserves the on the political side the compliments is Prime Minister Clark. Joe Clark was in charge, and he handled this all very skillfully, which was a delicate, explosive issue. And Mr. Clark handled it beautifully, as he did the foreign affairs in the 7 years he was Minister of Foreign Affairs in my government. He did an outstanding job. This was a very seminal moment in Canadian diplomatic history, and filled with all kinds of challenges. And Mr. Clark handled, and his foreign affairs minister, Flora MacDonald, handled it beautifully.
That was former Prime Minister Brian Mulroney remembering Ken Taylor, the former ambassador to Iran, who orchestrated the Canadian caper during the Iran hostage crisis, which inspired the movie Argo.
That's it for this week's episode.
For more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.